Fred Film Radio.
Angelo Cerbi, Fred Film Radio from Torino, from the See You Sound Festival. I'm very happy to be here with Steven Kijak. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You have a huge part of the festival dedicated to yourself. The festival will open with your film, Shoplifter of the World, and then we have Sid and Judy and Stones in Exile. Let's start with the opening film, which is not a documentary, actually. It's a feature. It's a fiction film dedicated, of course, to the Smith, as the title reveals, and dedicated to a specific thing, a specific time of the Smith career, which is the end of it. How did you come with the idea, and how did you build up the narrative around the Smith songs?
Well, you know, it's based on a true story, mm-hmm. sort of. It's really based on this urban myth that someone, a young fan, tried to hold up the radio station when the band broke up, you know. He was so upset that he decided to hold up the top 40 radio station and make them play the Smiths all night long. It's a great story, but it was not true. In fact, this young man tried but failed in mm-hmm. his mission to hold up the radio station. However, somehow the story grew and grew, in so much so that I think even Morrissey believed that there was this violent holdup at the station, you know, in the honor of the Smiths. So we just thought, you know, it's a great like one night in the life of kind of story, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a great premise for a story. It's a way to pay tribute to the band without actually telling their story. It's about fandom. It's about nostalgia. We just leaned into the myth and brought it to life. You know?
And this thing should have happened in the U.S. This was the, mm-hmm. the myth. And it's really, for us European, it's really astonishing and nice to see that the Smiths were so big in U.S. as well. You know, we thought it was just a European thing.
Oh, no. All of that music of that era was really huge in the States, at least in certain parts, you know. We have a legendary DJ, Rodney Bingenheimer, Rodney on the Rock, and K-Rock in California. It was from Southern California, who was probably single-handedly responsible for breaking all the British bands in America, probably from the mid-70s up through the mid-80s into the 90s. So it really grew a massive cult for British rock in America, especially in the 80s. And then, of course, MTV brought them all to us. But oddly, the Smiths resisted MTV, you know? Like, they didn't really feature in the videos, so... You know, it was a little more of a cult phenomenon, but, you know, I think all of the outsiders, all of the sort of freaks and punks and weirdos, you know, gravitated towards these bands. We felt like they stood for us, you know, and spoke for us.
Yeah, also because, you know, the myth creates a very huge and strong fandom, even stronger than a regular fandom for any regular band. And actually, the film adds this kind of freshness in the narrative and in the main characters, because they're young, they're desperate. The desperation that you have when you're young, which is gigantic. Mm-hmm. Everything is exaggerated. You know, everything is over the top. How did you did they know Smith, the actors? Or did you have to educate them towards the Smith music?
Some did, some didn't. I gotta say, our lead actress, Helena Howard, who plays Cleo, who's the most desperate of them all, she was raised by a new wave mom, mm-hmm. right? Her mother was my age, so her mother was a total 80s chick. And her mother's best friend was sort of like, Helena didn't have a, you know, was raised by a single mom. And so her mother's best friend was like her uncle, right? And this guy was a Smiths freak. He traveled around Europe following them on tour. So when she came to set, she had the program for their European tour for Meet His Murder. You know, she was clutching it to her chest, and she wanted it to be in Cleo's room somewhere, you know? So her connection went very deep, whereas some of the others, just decided to quickly study up on the band, and were fans while they were making the film. I don't know if they still listen to the Smiths, but yeah, at least Helena really was deep into it.
The role played by Joey Manganiello is really fun because he is the DJ who is kidnapped and forced. He hates new music. He hates new rock, British bands. He just wants U.S. rock and roll. Mm-hmm. This is what he wants. But he's little by little captivated and convinced about the quality of the music, because the thing that was the thing, you know, mm-hmm. there was the new wave was ostracized just for the sake of it. Nobody even listened to it. Mm-hmm. Did he have a kind of similar experience in his youth? Did he use some recollections from his memories to build up his characters, that, as far as you know?
Absolutely. Joe, who's also a producer on the film, he was a metalhead jock in high school who played football. He was injured, so he could then no longer play football, so he decided to join the drama club where everyone was listening to the Smiths. You know what I mean? So he fell in love with a girl who was into the Smiths. So he has kind of a little bit of both. He is very much more of a metalhead. So it was perfect. He really fit right into that role. But in a way, I think the DJ is my favorite character, because him and Dean, the kid who holds up the station, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, they are the same person,
yeah.
Just separated by a generation, mm-hmm. who come to understand each other and share a common love of music, yeah. You know.
So. This is not only a music film, it's a generational film as well, because you tell us the story of that part of our life when we are growing up, when we have to make decision to turn into a grown-up, and we are not very sure, because there's one of these characters, of these kids, they are supposed to leave to go to the army the next day, and he's not very sure of what he wants to do and who he is, actually. Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to portray this difficult time of our lives without being obvious, without being like predictable or already seen?
I don't think so. I mean, like I said, the inciting incident was based on a true story, but all those characters are also true. I mean, mm-hmm. it's me and my friends, you know, they're all very autobiographical stories, things that I lived through and my friends lived through. So it felt very true to my life. And yeah, I think the way we tried to handle it in such a way that it wasn't the cliche American high school movie in ways. You know, the dilemma wasn't like us against the jocks or something. We wanted the dilemmas and the dramas to be internal within themselves, and expressed through the music and through their friendships. You know, it's not, there isn't a huge amount of drama in the film. There are little small revelations.
And there are, and music is everywhere besides the Smiths, besides the rock and roll that we hear. But the looks of kids are, you know, mutilated by music, because one of the girls like Madonna in the 90s. And how much was influential to your growing up music? Personally,
what do you mean?
When you grow up, how much music was an influence?
Huge. I mean, yeah, I worked in a record store. Mm. I stole records. I tried to dress like all of my heroes. I think for maybe 3 years, I thought I was in The Cure. So everything was black and I had huge hair. And then I discovered the Smiths. So I cut my hair and I bought vintage, you know, sport coats and cardigans. It was everything. I mean, it was very tribal back then.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have the internet. We had very limited access to music and imagery from these bands. So the imagery itself was very important, you know, just even from holding the album covers and having these things to look at, seeing them in magazines or, you know, seeing a video. I mean, I must have played my Cure VHS collection hundreds of times, studying the look, the shirts and the necklaces and how he did his hair, all that shit. It's like, it informs everything about you. It's almost pathetic in a way. Like,
well, no,
you
know? Well, no.
But that's what
it
kids
would be
did.
Pathetic maybe now because we have many other ways to get information in music. But back then, it just was either you had the records or the VHS or nothing else.
And your look, I mean, it identified you. You know, like I said, it's all absolutely tribal, you know. All those looks were very specific to that time. And we tried to really recreate them perfectly.
You put in the film a lot of footage from the interviews back in the days of the Smiths, of Morrissey. How was the relationship with him and then... to use this footage, were they happy about it? It was because it's not exactly an easy man to deal with.
No, well, we didn't really. I didn't deal with him directly. You know, we had to license the music, and Morrissey and Johnny Marr had to mutually agree. And that's, you know, the film took forever to make. It was very, very difficult. Yeah, I mean, the footage is just, they had no say. I mean, we licensed it and put it in there because we wanted people that might not really know who they are or what they looked like or what they really represented to culture to see a little bit of the reality of the band so they could really kind of understand the world a little bit more. I mean, that's that.
Do you know if they watched the film?
I don't, you know, Morrissey did. He's supportive.
Good.
For whatever that's worth.
Well,
it's a long story with him. Johnny, I don't know. I had met him and worked with him before years ago. Very nice man. So I think he did. I haven't heard anything negative. So I'm sure if he hated it, we'd find out.
Exactly.
You know?
I know. The other film of yours here at CU Sound is one of the other two is Sid and Judy. This year is the 100 years anniversary of the birth of Miss Garland. So we are talking about Judy Garland and Sid Luft. And you chose to tell us the story of Judy's life in that specific time frame when she was Mrs. Luft. Why did you choose that?
It was very practical. My manager at the time knew the man who ran the Sid Luft Trust. Like, he had worked with Sid and had all of his archive. And there was a memoir Sid, they were about to publish. Sid wrote a memoir of his life with Judy. And they owned the rights to the TV show. They had family photographs, home recordings. They just had all the stuff, you know, and were interested in doing a film. So it was just an incident where, you know, the materials in an archive just are so valuable and interesting that they kind of tell you how to make the film. So, yeah, we decided just to base it on that relationship and tell that story through Sid's eyes. But then also you come to learn her whole story and get a broader understanding of who Judy Garland was. As well. So, yeah, it was a really fabulous film.
It is a really fabulous film, and it is a really sad film as well because, you know, Judy's story is sad, the way she was exploited and used by anyone. Maybe not by Sid, but by the industry for sure. Was there something that you didn't know about it that you found out through the making of the film?
Well, I really wasn't a Judy Garland fan at all. It was just an opportunity to tell a story. So almost the whole I knew the basics. I'd seen almost none of her movies. Obviously, I had seen A Star Is Born. The whole thing was a learning curve, right? Mm-hmm. It was fantastic to really look closely at her. It was a revelation, really. I think some of the most phenomenal things I've ever seen are some of her performances on her TV show.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely mind-blowing talent, you know, even at that late stage of her life. Just seeing that clip of her doing Old Man River, we knew we had to end it. Somehow it was just that one performance gave us the whole film. So whatever happens, it has to end right there because It's devastating.
Yeah, it's devastating, right? Yeah, yeah, because she had this kind of quality, the real star quality. Then when she was singing, she turned into something else, some other entity, not even a human, maybe.
Yeah.
Because she was more than a singer.
She really was. I mean, well, she was a consummate performer. You know, what was interesting to really come to understand was she was one of those rare performers whose career almost covered the entire spectrum of, like, the creative arts, from vaudeville, right?
Mm,
the
yeah.
famous theatrical kind of musical comedy form of the 20s and 30s, if you will. She was a huge star on radio. And then, you know, had this phenomenal career in the movies, and then went back to the stage, you know, and became one of the highest selling concert performers of her day. You know, Vegas, Carnegie Hall, all of it. I mean, it's every creative art form rolled into one, and she did all of it. It's really extraordinary.
Was it a long process to create the film?
That one was not very long. That, I think, took a year and a half. We tend to make the—I say we. I mean, I have a whole creative team I work with over and over again. And I was making The Smiths in the middle of making that. I mean, it was— I was doing like three things at once. It was kind of a nightmare, but, you know, we got it done.
Talking about the last film that Sriyosan is showing, which is Storms in Exile, again, you choose a specific smaller time frame in the story of the band, of a specific event in the creative and public history of the band, and then you tell us their words around that. Why did you choose, again, I'm asking all the same questions, but
yeah, no,
why
it's fine.
Did you choose?
Honestly, a lot of these things choose me, you know. Mm. They were reissuing that album and wanted a film to tell that story. So I was hired to do it. But I love this, the limited story window, you know. Mm-hmm. I think this, it's obviously easier. But it gives you a focus. You have a real specificity to it. It's about place. It's about an era, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, and it's a phenomenal record to be able to just tell the making of one thing.
Yeah.
There's so much story just in that, you know. And we had, an incredible archive to work with, but used by choice some very limited assets. You know, it was like our paint box had only maybe five colors. You know, uh-huh. We had the films of Robert, the one film Robert Frank made called Cocksucker Blues.
Yeah.
That was banned, right? It was about their 1972 tour. So we had all of his work print, like all his raw footage, and we kind of remixed it to mm-hmm. make this film. And the films of Dominique Tarlet,
yeah.
The one photographer who was there when they were making the record. And then Jim Marshall was photographing them in L.A. when they were mixing it and then touring it. So really, it's like these three visual assets were used to mix up to make the film. It was really great to be very controlled.
Yeah.
Then we made some of our own archive that to mm-hmm. trick people to thinking that we were there.
It's true what you said, that if you have a specific story to tell, it gives you the opportunity to tell the whole story, mm-hmm. but through more specific mm-hmm. narrative, mm-hmm. which is easier. It also for you to do and for us to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It's more compelling.
Yeah.
What is your favorite Stones record besides this one?
Besides Exile on Main Street? Oh, I love Sticky Fingers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just the fucking coolest thing ever. I'm sorry, I'm swearing. I don't know if I can do that on your show.
It makes sense with the content, yeah.
It's the greatest thing ever, mm-hmm. you know. Mick Taylor's playing it just elevates everything. It's a great record. Mm-hmm. It really is, I think, one of the finest records ever made.
And one last question. Why do you think that lately music is coming back again into the movie industry as a way to tell stories and a content as well. We have many films, both documentary and fiction, about musicians or specific time in music, or more than like 15 years ago.
I know. I don't understand. There weren't as many when I started making the music films. I would like to get more of those for myself. Yeah, I don't know. People like them. It's just there's so many stories to tell. I don't know if the film Summer of Soul has come here yet.
Not yet.
I mean, that kind of thing, right? It's Questlove making a film about the Harlem Music Festival, yeah. Right? Essentially the Black Woodstock.
Yeah.
So to me, those are it's like stories that haven't been told yet, you know, again, with archive that no one's seen. There's a lot of that just buried out there. And when you find it, it's gold.
It's like,
you know?
It's like the Get Back thing about the Beatles that Peter Jackson did. Or like the Amazing Grace, the concert, you know.
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. So
it's cultural preservation.
Oh yeah,
you want to preserve it for generations to see
it's
this and to learn
and
from
cultural
it.
Cultural preservation.
Yeah,
because you also teach people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're just fun, aren't they?
Oh, they are a lot. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for your time to Stephen Kijak,
I hope,
director of Shoplifter of the World and Sid and Judy and Stones in Exile here at the See You Sound Festival in Torino. I'm Angelo Cerbi for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.